I have to go upstairs and record something again, so
quiet.
Quiet and do not
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
Hi, you're listening to Pandemic, a new podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Cullum O'Mungoyne, and most days of the week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. The sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat sometimes, as correspondents and I will be recording this, in many cases, on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Friday, May 29th, and at the time of recording this episode at about 6 o'clock in the evening, the number of people who have died around the world with COVID-19 stands at over 362,000. Confirmed cases globally, according to the Johns Hopkins University tracker, stand at around 5.9 million people. Here in Ireland, according to the latest Department of Health figures, six further deaths of people diagnosed with COVID-19 have been recorded in the last 24 hours. 39 additional confirmed cases of the virus have also been notified to the Department of Health. There have now been a total of 1,645 COVID-19 related deaths in Ireland and a total of 24,876 confirmed cases. In the second half of this episode, Brazil, with the second highest number of cases in the world and a president who's a lockdown skeptic, will talk to journalist Alex Hymans about how that's all working. Back home, and this evening a post-cabinet press conference was held in which we got some new answers and were left with a few questions too. The Taoiseach, the Minister for Finance and the Minister for Children all spoke to the media. Hospitals, anomalies in the temporary wage subsidy scheme, childcare and schools reopening all came up, and we'll have a look at the latter two categories, schools and childcare, in a moment with our correspondent Orla O'Donnell. But first, private hospitals. At €115 million per month, the state took over the capacity of private hospitals in case of a surge. That scheme is to end. Here's Leo Varadkar on that.
We didn't need to use the private hospitals to the extent that we thought we might. We very much stand over the decision to take control of the private hospitals back in March. It was the right thing to do, and we have made some good use of them since then, but certainly nothing approaching the level of use that we thought we might have required back in March or February. So under the contract that we have with the private hospitals, it runs until the end of June, but we have to indicate to them today as to whether or not we're going to extend that as we can. So we are indicating today to the private hospitals that we're not going to extend the contract beyond the end of June. But between now and then, we will negotiate with the private hospitals a new agreement. And our objective in that new agreement is to have step-in powers, if you like, or step-in rights to take control of ICU beds and critical care capacity and other beds if we need them, if there is a second wave that is worse than the first one, or if we find that a second wave of the coronavirus coincides with a bad flu season in the winter. And the second objective is to come to an agreement with the private hospitals, similar to what we have already through the NTPF, to use their facilities to provide healthcare for public patients. Because as you know, there's a growing backlog of people waiting on operations, waiting for outpatient appointments, waiting on scans. We may need to use that additional capacity that they have in the private hospitals for public patients, as we've done in the past.
We also heard that a resolution has been arrived at on the issue of people returning from maternity, paternity or adoptive leave and finding themselves closed out of the temporary wage subsidy scheme paid to employers to keep staff on the payroll. Here's the Minister for Finance, Pascal Donoghue.
To date, over 50,000 employers are now participating in the scheme, and we now have well over 400,000 employees participating on the scheme with their employer. The scheme, as you know, provides a subsidy from government to cover a portion of the employee's wage bill in circumstances where the employer's business has been severely affected by COVID-19. And shortly after the introduction of this scheme, the government and I became aware of an anomaly where certain employees whose personal circumstances related to either maternal or paternal leave meant they weren't able to go back on the payroll via the wage subsidy scheme. We're recognising the very unique circumstances of those who are returning to work after a period of maternity or adoptive leave, and we are doing this crucially by allowing equal treatment with other participants on the wage subsidy scheme. Technical details of how this will be implemented will be published by the Revenue Commissioner this afternoon, but I do want to highlight to employers that a manual process will be adopted. It will require input and information from the employers, and I would encourage them to contact the Revenue Commissioner as soon as possible so that we can ensure that those employees who are not able to enter this scheme for those reasons will shortly be able to join.
So a bit more detail to be teased out on that, and we may return to that subject. And on another area on which further reading might be needed, here's Catherine Zappone, the Minister for Children, on the new proposal to open creches.
Many of you have probably heard a little bit about play pods already. I know many parents of young children are familiar with that concept. We're introducing that concept, that practice of play pods, to keep children as safe as possible. We know that young children can't do social distancing. And older children cannot do social distancing in a play context, as we have in our school-age childcare setting. So it's my belief that play pods will allow children to play in a natural, spontaneous, and creative way. I am very, very pleased that the guidance from the Health Protection and Surveillance Center indicates that the size of the play pod can be in line with our childcare regulations. For example, for children in full day care, this means that for children under the age of one, there could be 6 children and 2 adults in a play pod. Or for 2 years old, there could be 12 children and 2 adults in a play pod. The full details of the guidance is being published on the HPSC website this afternoon. I think it's probably up already, and it will also be available on the Department of Children and Youth Affairs website as well.
And so to schools. We heard yesterday from the Minister for Education that schools may not open fully in September.
With the 2-metre rule in place, it's going to look very, very difficult to see all students back in September. Even with a 1-metre rule, it's very difficult to see all students back in September. So
he also said he wouldn't be accepting a half return.
Where we're at now in the month of May, under the current guidelines, and being honest once again with the public, that it will be looking at potentially a half return. But I won't be accepting that.
Well, today the Taoiseach said schools would in fact be opening even earlier in August. And a half return, or at least some class of a partial return, may well be on the cards after all.
And he confirmed that it is the intention of government to reopen our primary and secondary schools at the beginning of the school year. The school year, as you know, begins at the end of August, not September. So it is intended to open primary schools and secondary schools at the end of August, at the normal time that the academic year begins. And they're making good progress towards that. Particularly paying attention to new and emerging research about the level of risk attached to schools being open. And as the research continues to come in, we know that it's not a no-risk scenario, but it is a low-risk scenario to open schools. And in addition to that, are learning very much from the experience of other countries that have opened schools at least partially already. We're also learning from the experience of countries that have had to reimpose restrictions. And as you know, there have been outbreaks in schools in France. I heard today that 200 schools in South Korea have had to be closed and moved online because of outbreaks there. So we're aware of that too. But we're certainly working towards that target, which we believe we will achieve, of opening primary and secondary schools at the beginning of the new school year at the end of August. That might not mean that every student is able to return every day for the full day, but our objective is to have things as close to normal as possible.
Now, when our correspondent Orla O'Donnell heard the Minister for Education yesterday and saw the article based on his remarks about the potential delay on reopening, she retweeted a link to that article with an emoji summing up her reaction on Twitter. Let's see if anything's changed with what's been announced today. Okay, Orla, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Colm. How are you?
Are you? I saw that tweet, Orla. There was a tweet with the scream emoji. Was it yesterday when the schools weren't going to go back? You might be in slightly better humour today, but...
Not much, no. I think, like all parents, I've reached the end of my ability to homeschool my children. I know I need a teacher. I need some professionals. I need some professional help.
Yeah, I need it as quickly as possible.
I
think we all need professional help, and not just with the homeschooling at this stage. But anyway, before we get into what was said at that government briefing this afternoon about the proposed return to school, let's go into some of the medical evidence you've been looking through and the public health considerations that might be taken into account about people sending their kids back to school.
Yes, this was a report by six public health doctors from the HSE looking at the six cases reported, confirmed in this country, of people with COVID-19 from school environments. And obviously, they contracted the disease before the schools were closed on March the 12th. The doctors found that schools were not a high-risk setting for the transmission of COVID-19, and they concluded that the reopening of schools should be considered as an early rather than a late measure in the lifting of restrictions. They looked at these six cases. There were three children. One primary school child, two secondary school children, and three adults, including one teacher and two people who were involved in giving educational courses in a school setting. And they looked at their contacts, more than 1,000 contacts who were exposed to these confirmed cases in the classroom, during sports lessons, during music lessons, choir practice, quite a high risk scenario. And they found that amongst these contacts, there were no confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the following 14 days. The only documented transmission of the disease that occurred was between two of the adults and another adult in an environment outside the school. Now, they said obviously these were small numbers and none of those looked at were under 10 years old, but they said that if appropriate measures were taken, such as proper hand hygiene, respiratory etiquette for students and staff, and also looking at the areas where staff gather as well as where children gather, and also making sure people with symptoms don't come into school, as staff and students, and that they're monitored and that there's contact tracing, they said if these kind of measures were adhered to, there was no reason why schools couldn't be safely reopened.
All right. So far, so relieved, say most parents, because that kind of teed up what was said at the government briefing then this afternoon, with the Taoiseach saying that it was the intention to open schools at the beginning of the school year. There had been some talk that everybody would go back on the same terms. You wouldn't have people going back on a partial basis, but from what we heard this afternoon, that didn't seem to be exactly the case.
Well, it's looking more, at the moment, more and more likely that that is not going to be the case. The Taoiseach said, yes, that the government does intend to reopen primary and secondary schools at the end of August. So that all sounds good to me, particularly. And he said they were looking at new and emerging research. And I'm sure the examination by these doctors of the cases that actually have happened here played into that decision. They were also looking at other countries, how they have coped with the schools being reopened, countries that may have had to row back a bit on either of restrictions if outbreaks have occurred. And Leo Varadkar said they knew it was not a no-risk scenario, but it was a low-risk scenario. However, it's obviously not ever as simple as that. He said they wanted to achieve this target, they believed it was achievable, but he said that not all students may be able to return every day for a full day. And obviously the issue of social distancing will come into it. There has been a lot of talk about whether or not that distance of 2 metres might be the advice or guidance of people staying 2 metres away from each other might be reduced to 1 metre. But if it remains at 2 metres, that obviously poses problems for schools and the space they would have available for their students. So there are obviously an awful lot of details to be worked out about the logistics of how this is going to actually happen. But I suppose it is reassuring to hear that the intention at the moment is that schools will reopen in some shape or form at the end of August, at the beginning of September, as they would normally do.
If that was the mission, to offer some form of reassurance that the school are going to be open, then mission accomplished. But there are still plenty of questions with regard to details. And also on the area of childcare, Orla, for people whose kids aren't in school, or maybe whose kids are in school and need after school, or other children mm-hmm. who need creche care, there are still questions outstanding there as well.
Yes, there has been some guidance about what the government or what is envisaged might happen in childcare facilities. So guidance from department to childcare providers says it's not recommended that the children under the age of 6 would be able to socially distance from each other because it's not possible. Those older than 6 will be asked to try to keep their distance and avoid physical contact. And there is talk of these play pods. So children and their carers would be together in play pods and they would keep their distance from other play pods, and that would be the way that they would impose some kind of controls and an effort to keep down infections. So they haven't decided how many children should be in each play pod, but they will be there. They've been told that there shouldn't be contact between two play pods and they should remain apart as far as possible indoors and outdoors. It depends, I suppose, on the size of the facility and the number of children involved as to how many play pods will be in each facility or in each age group. Toys shouldn't be shared between the pods and staff should socially distance from each other in the same pod as far as practicable. Catherine Zappone, the Minister for Children, gave some indications of what might be envisaged when she said children under the age of one in full daycare, you might have a pod with 6 children and 2 adults. For older children, it might be 12 children and 2 adults. And she said that it was inevitable there would be some transmission of the virus in childcare. And anybody who has had children in creche knows that infections and diseases and viruses spread like wildfire in these facilities. But she said the guidelines that will be published will provide the best way to deal with expected outbreaks.
And there's a couple of questions from the point of view, I'm sure, of childcare providers, people who work in childcare, and indeed parents as well, about a lot of money issues, and it would be safe to say we didn't get the answers on that. But on a local level, Catherine Zappone said there could be some level of prioritisation, and the hope was that healthcare workers at the very least would get priorities. But just to go back to the education, secondary and primary schools, the Taoiseach mentioned Denmark. He said, there's, you know, they have a co-located system of primary schools and secondary schools, and that had allowed them to open. You were mentioned there, he said, international examples are going to inform their thinking. So they have kind of a couple of months of that before we open our schools anyway.
Yes, I suppose the hope is that the next 3 months will enable people to work out what we're going to do and what the schools can do to open safely and to ensure that people are protected as much as possible from the risk of infection and yet can return to some kind of normality. And I suppose the hope as well is that maybe as we go through the phases and if everything goes according to plan and the reproduction rate of the virus stays low, as we've heard today from Professor Philip Nolan, it seems to be remaining remarkably low and remarkably stable despite the easing of restrictions. If things go on like that, well, then, but obviously that may give some hope and comfort to childcare providers and schools that they can maybe the social distancing requirement to stay 2 metres away from each other may be brought down to 1 metre. Maybe there may be some more flexibility in terms of how people can operate and what kind of provisions can be put in place. But our schools are already, as everybody knows, have very high numbers of pupils per class. So there are going to be very severe difficulties for people in creches and in schools about dividing children up and making sure they can stay away from each other as much as possible, and the teachers will also be safe. So we'll have to see how things develop over the next few months. But obviously, if the situation with the virus remains stable and remains positive, that gives positivity that other areas can start to open up and we can return to some kind of normal life.
Okay, thanks a million, Orla. All the best. With over 438,000 cases of COVID-19, Brazil has the second highest number of infections in the world. With deaths from the virus at close to 27,000, the country has the highest number of fatalities outside of the US and Europe. Its leader, Jair Bolsonaro, has dismissed the coronavirus as a little cold. So what does life inside Brazil look like? Dutch journalist Alex Heymans lives in Brazil. I called him earlier. And if you're wondering why we begin and end our conversation, os coelga is cainchor lifa coelga, Alex.
Hello.
Hi, Alex.
Hello, Colm.
Hey, conosco corsi. Yeah, gabra. Well, tuss a railing top of the end of an ish.
So, Berla Martin.
Yeah, Berla. Okay, sure. How are you?
I'm good, thankfully. Where I live in Salvador, which is Brazil's third largest city, rather than going full lockdown, the mayor has decided to put in place regionalized lockdowns based on statistics in specific areas in the city. For example, if there's a lot of cases in a specific area, or if people aren't staying inside enough in a particular area, they'll lock down just that one specific area rather than putting lockdown regulations in place in the whole city. So in where I live, I can go wherever I want, really. So there's several municipalities in Brazil where there's a curfew in place. Now, we don't have that here in Salvador. So, and as we speak, the city of São Paulo in the south of Brazil, Brazil's largest city, is actually opening up again, even though corona cases are through the roof there as well.
So can you take us through it then, maybe from the start, coronavirus starts spreading out across the world. What was the political response in Brazil at the beginning?
None, really. It's now been established that coronavirus arrived in Brazil before Carnival. And Carnival, of course, is a big thing in Brazil. Lots of people getting together, getting drunk, and possibly spreading the virus. Thinking back, Carnival would have had to been cancelled. That didn't happen. Then I have to say, actually, comparing to some places in Europe, the particular city where I live in Brazil, Salvador, was quite fast off the mark with schools and gyms closing down shopping centers being shut down. The beach was closed off as well. The beach has been closed off now for about a month and a half. Really, I think that can be seen in locally here in Salvador, that we're the third largest city in the country, but the number of cases is relatively small compared to places like Rio de Janeiro or São Paulo or the Amazon region.
And what has been the problem there? Because people may be aware of the neighborhoods in Brazil, the favelas, where people would be packed in quite close together. There's, I think, something in the region of 30 million people in Brazil without access to running water, these kind of issues. I mean,
yes.
Is that where it's concentrated, or is it more widespread than that?
It certainly wasn't at the start, because you have to understand that coronavirus was imported into Brazil by the upper class or higher middle class. People who could travel, who came back from Italy. So up until maybe 2 weeks ago, here in Salvador, most cases were actually in upper class neighborhoods. It's only now starting to spread to favelas or lower class neighborhoods. And obviously, like you said, conditions there are really different. People would generally share maybe one or two bedroom house with six, seven, eight people. There mightn't always be running water. Obviously, money is an issue, so you can't go out and buy alcohol gel, which is a big thing here in Brazil.
And you probably have to go out to work if you have a job. The idea of self-isolating with no income and no support is going to be difficult.
It is, and it's proving to be very hard indeed, because there's 38 million Brazilians who work in what you'd call the informal sector. We're talking about people who wash cars on the street, who delivery guys, people who sell sweets in buses, people who sell fish, and they would have no social welfare network to fall back on. For the last month and a half, really, the government has been trying to put in place a system where it's a cash transfer system where these people get 600 real, that's about 100 euro a month. But it's proven to be very complicated to actually access that support. So people are only now getting that money into their account. And obviously it's not an awful lot of money. So the incentive to stay at home and not go out to work isn't really that great. People really have mouths to feed and are going out to work.
And on a high level, there's been coverage of protests in Brazil, people going out to their balconies with pots and pans to make their displeasure with the government felt. What has that stemmed from, and in what areas is that seen?
The pots and pans have actually died down. I think people have just basically grown numb to the amount of bad news and to the declarations from the powers that be, because that's really what it was a protest against. It was against the way the federal government has not been dealing with the situation. But like I said, these protests, it was every night for about a fortnight, but that was about a month and a half ago at the start of the corona crisis. And I think people just basically grew numb to the numbers and to the government's, the federal government's attitude. On the other hand, though, there have also been protests in favor of the federal government and against lockdown, but they've been smaller in number.
And so for anyone who's unfamiliar with it, what has the response of the federal government been? What, particularly the country's leader, Bolsonaro, what has his attitude been towards coronavirus, and what response has he been prescribing to it?
Bolsonaro is on record as describing coronavirus as just a bit of a flu. He's against lockdown measures. He thinks the economy is more important. And he's also been a supporter of chloroquine.
This is chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine, the anti-malarial tablet that...
Yeah, exactly. He's
President
a
Trump
strong
is,
believer.
Yeah.
Both are strong believers in chloroquine. So he's been trying to push that, and he's actually lost two health ministers in the space of less than a month.
Right. To lose one health minister is unfortunate, as Oscar Wilde might have said.
During a corona crisis, yes. Yeah. To lose two, Brazil is basically, after the United States, we've got the largest number of cases at the moment, and we don't have a health minister. We have a general from the military who is looking after the health ministry.
So who fills in the gaps then? Because I've read, I think there was an article in the New Humanitarian that was looking at the community responses to coronavirus, that a lot of the gaps seem to be filled at favela level and in local areas by charities or non-governmental organisations where they've engaged in fundraising to try and turn around a community response to the virus.
Yes, there are efforts like that, but really, I mean, those gaps are filled by local government. I think really what's clear in Brazil is that local government, municipal government and state level government is dealing with the corona crisis a lot better than the federal government are.
Right. So thank goodness for a regionalized government at which things operate at a different level, because it sounds like if you were depending on the federal government, you'd be waiting a long time for an adequate response.
You would, but on the other hand, it means that we have a patchwork of guidelines and regulations, and which isn't that helpful if you're trying to combat an infectious disease in a large country.
And what resources are available at local and at local and regional level for them to mount that kind of a response? Is that the level that the taxes are raised at?
Apparently, I have some doubts as to where the money that's currently being spent is actually coming from, and what measures are going to have to be taken in the future to pay for all of this. But at the moment, it doesn't seem that money is lacking. There's hospitals being built, there's ventilators being bought, and we're not talking about one or two, but about hundreds of them. So there's money being spent on food for the poor. There's obviously cash being transferred to people who don't have social welfare and who can't go out to work, even though that's proved to be problematic. But yes, money doesn't seem to be an issue right at the moment, but obviously it is going to be in the future. The economy has ground to a halt. We're hearing today that we're on the brink of a new recession, and Brazil never really recovered from the last one anyway. So it doesn't really bode well for the economy in the future.
And in terms of the political fallout then, finally, Alex, I mean, you look at a neighbouring country like Argentina, who the last time I checked, the death toll was in the hundreds. And
yes.
Contrast that
and
with Brazil. Yeah, so I mean,
Argentina went into total national lockdown almost the day after coronavirus arrived in the country. It's the perfect example of how to deal with things and how not to deal with things, I suppose. But yeah, the political fallout, the bizarre thing is that the headlines, even though we're in the middle of a corona crisis, the headlines in the country are taken up with other political scandals. The Bolsonaro clan, because it's not just the president, but his sons as well, who are deputies, who are members of parliament, are all connected to or being investigated with regards to a fake news scandal. So rather than focusing on the coronavirus crisis, Bolsonaro has been focused on trying to save his mandate, basically.
This is the scandal over which he's lost his justice minister as well, is it?
It is.
And that's what the focus largely is on. You were saying earlier that people have become numbed to the coronavirus aspect of things. Is a lot of the concentration on this feeding into a wider discontent, or is he solid in the base he has?
The funny thing is, there's a new poll out today in which his disapproval rating has grown to about 47%, but his support base remains stable at about 30%. So a third of Brazilians, even 2 months into the corona crisis, is still supportive of the president. That support base is very, very sturdy. It just hasn't declined, even though the undecided middle, let's call them that, have been starting to get more disenchanted with the current government.
Alex, before we let you go, you're also a writer of fiction, and you're saying you're in a kind of a lockdown there at the moment. Is it a help or a hindrance?
It's a hindrance, because as an American author that I admire a lot, Curtis Sittenfeld, recently said, working at home during a pandemic is completely different from working at home. I just find it very hard to focus, because even though I'm trying to limit the times that I access news or Twitter or any form of
answer calls from RTE looking to talk to you about coronavirus. Yeah,
I try to limit that to about twice a day, and still I find myself not being able to concentrate very much.
Right.
But I think a lot of writers are suffering from similar problems.
Okay. Well, the best of luck with whatever you're working on.
Thanks very much, Colm.
Okay. Stay safe. Slán, go mílim agat.
Mílim agat.
All right, Slán. And that's it from the Pandemic Podcast. For another week, we'll be back on Tuesday with another episode. Until then, have a good weekend, stay safe, and if you have children, enjoy Monday in particular and the no homeschooling.